Greetings. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Heart and Soul Broadcasting Services. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today I'm in conversation with Gift Ostalos Siziva, activist and human rights defender. If you enjoy this conversation, remember to subscribe, to like, and to share. Let's get down to some work.
The next thing I woke up in ZANU-PF headquarters, I'm taken downstairs into their torture chambers, I presume. I think that our biggest victory was to allow young people to see the need for them to contribute in the politics, fundamentally in 2018 and up to 2023. I think that my biggest regret in politics is to some extent, abandon the role of comradely love.
Gift Ostalos Siziva, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
Thank you very much, Trevor, for hosting me.
I am delighted to have you here. I'm always fascinated by young people like you who choose to go into politics. You've been detained, arrested. You've been abducted, actually arrested multiple times. Has it been worth it?
Thank you very much. I think it has been worth it. When we came into politics, when we were student leaders at the University of Zimbabwe, the first thing that the union teaches you is about the struggle and the necessary commitments that are needed, and that so much depend on the fight for freedom and democracy in any society at any historic moment. So I think that it's been worth it. It is worth it because what is life without a legacy? Those that have been captured by history, those that have gone into annals of history of our society, the continent and the world, are people who dared to challenge the status quo ante for the sake of progress of society. So I think that in the smallest way possible, we've contributed to the discourse of the politics of our country and the future of our own children. So I think that it is worth it.
So what vision of Zimbabwe are you fighting for? The vision that makes you ready to endure the abductions, the arrest, and the suffering? Paint to us the vision of Zimbabwe that you're fighting for.
No, thanks very much, Mkoma Trevor. I think that for us and for me in particular, two things are very critical. I think that our struggle is about the fulfillment of the liberation dream. And the way we philosophize the liberation struggle was centered fundamentally on two things. One, the will of the people to be realized, the right for black people to choose leaders of their choice. And that even captured in our own constitution is one of the sacrosanct rights, universal suffrage, they would call it, in the liberation trenches. And it's said, of course, that we're still fighting for that because the lifting of the Union Jack was supposed to signal that black people now are able to choose leaders of their choice. But also, philosophers inform us that this is what gives mandate to those that govern, legitimacy, what philosophers call a social contract, the relationship between those who govern, those that are being governed. So that, to us, is the first and most important thing. Secondly, for me, is the issue of the economy, transformation, so that people live better. I don't think that ordinary Zimbabweans and the oppressed world over are fighting for anything fundamentally utopian. They just want clean water. They just want to go to school. They just want to find medicine in hospitals, just to live better. So I think for us, that's the vision. That's the mission. That's the central strategic objective of the National Democratic Project, which we're part of, to make the lives of ordinary people better, you know. And when we achieve that, of course, in terms of the proposition, in summary, that's a democratic developmental state. That's what some of us see being the future of this country, and as the only sustainable way for us to transform the lives of ordinary citizens. So it is the fulfillment of the liberation dream for it to mean something to an ordinary person, to a young person who was born after 1980, to the Gen Z, to the millennials, to the cuckoo generation. Mm. The liberation must mean something. It must not always be political rhetoric and the exhausted nationalist rhetoric.
Mm. You said something about what made you get into politics, which was your experiences as you were growing up, seeing the suffering of people and so forth. Do you want to take us there in terms of how your upbringing formed the kind of politician that you've become, your experiences that moved you to get into politics?
Thank you very much. I think that I grew up in Tshabalala. That's where I was born. And obviously, you get to live the realities of poverty, the brokenness of our society, the struggles of 2008 when I was in high school, and of course, the struggles when we went to university. My own father, having worked for white people as a garden boy, coming from the countryside to come and work, and his 32 years experience in National Foods, and getting nothing from NASA, fundamentally caused problems because he lost his life because of the stress of the experience of pensions. You work for 32 years and then you get nothing. And this is 2008, 2009. There's hunger in the country and you can't afford a tuition fee. You can't afford school uniforms and you are subjected to this humiliation in an unequal society. I went to the university. Fortunately, when I got the scholarship funded by Econet, Strive Masiwa. But the fact that I knew that there are people who don't have access to this privilege of getting your tuition fee funded, and I began to understand that the majority of students at the University of Zimbabwe couldn't afford tuition fee, and I understood that our struggles for academic freedom, for tuition fee, could not be disconnected from the political question. So I think that consciousness that made me to understand. When I was growing up, I thought that maybe our family is unlucky. I felt that my father wasn't doing enough. I mean, I don't want anyone to go the life that I went through. I always tell this to my young brothers and nephews. Because we are in high school, Mkoma Trevor, in Glock High School. Your mother is coming with a public transport and others. Parents are driving cars. And my mother goes to the Orthodox Christian Church, the Apostle Faith Mission of Africa. So she's wearing the long dresses. You're in high school and the duke and she's in the public transport and others are eating bologna and strawberry dessert and Nando's. You have got a lunch tin of home cooked meal. And so all this inequality in society was striking me personally to the extent that I knew that no one should be subjected to this kind of life.
You know what I like? I'm going to stop you there because what I'm laughing because it's as if you're telling my story. My father was a cook for white people. My mother was a maid. And I blamed my father also for not doing it.
Mm.
The fact that I looked at other people's fathers driving cars and my father wasn't driving.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, Christmas comes, you know, the big thing when we grew up, Christmas was about new clothes and new shoes.
Exactly.
And
stuff. Yeah.
We were walking barefoot.
Yeah.
So I blamed my father because I didn't understand the economic circumstances.
Yeah.
Instead of blaming the government then, but I was too small to understand these things. So see where I'm going?
Precisely.
Because I hear you saying you thought your father wasn't.
Precisely. Here. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have this feeling, and I think that's why political consciousness and political education is important in society. And it answers why, when we were student leaders, we used to read, the Communist Manifesto. And we knew then, when we were students, that it is the most banned, you know, political literature. And it's not by accident, because you see the suppression that happens in institutions of higher learning, in the media space, in all the sectors of society, governments world over try to suppress, and people's access to necessary political literature, because they don't want you to realize that your own problems are linked to the national, political questions of the day.
Unpack to us perhaps the most painful moments as far as torture, abduction is concerned. Share with us some of those moments that you endured that the public might not be aware of, those dark moments that are part of the course of fighting the struggle.
So in 2016, I was supposed to be part and parcel of a bridal team in my church on Saturday in Bulawayo. Then I came to Harare because we're part and parcel of the National Elections Reform Campaign Program. And most of our activists in Tajamuka had been arrested, and this flag and this gown. So when I was now going back to find public transport to go back to the city on a Friday, I was followed and then I got abducted because the demo was sanctioned and all those kind of problems in our country. This is 2016. And then these people put me in a sack, and then they closed and were just roving around. They're beating me up anywhere. And I'm in the car and my head is down. Then the next thing, I wake up in ZANU-PF headquarters. I'm taken downstairs into their torture chambers, I presume. And obviously you are petrified. I got terrified, and I realized, clearly that probably this is my last moment with my life. And two things were very important to me, Mkoma Trevor. The first one was the grounding that had happened to me in terms of my political consciousness building, because it prepared me to understand that I must conquer the fear of death, because you're seeing blood, people are torturing you.
They're beating you.
And you can no longer feel the pain. There was this one old man who realized that everywhere in my body had been beaten up and blood was all over. He just started to step on my toes, just that, asking me, "You guys, regime change and all those things.
What do they want?"
They were asking who's funding the political activism and why we do what we do. And by then I couldn't answer. I was beaten all over. And I knew that these people are going to kill me. So I had conquered that fear of death. I was no longer feeling any pain. But also I felt for them. When you are closer to death, you feel for the person who's actually persecuting you. Because I knew that this old man is damaged because he was reciting his experience in the war, that my friends died. Do you guys want to undermine the death of my own friends and my comrades? So I understood that this is a person we must also be fighting for, to rescue him from this rut of confusion and misunderstanding that the democratization struggle is a fulfillment, not an aberration of the liberation project. Because if you listen to them today, the war veterans, they are now realizing that they've been an albatross to exactly what they want to struggle about. So for me,
at that particular moment, Siziva, is there no moment where you say to yourself, you regret what you're doing? Is there no moment when you feel like hopelessness and so forth? It can be easy in that space.
When you're a revolutionary, I was trained by the International Socialist Organization, and I must acknowledge its role in grounding us to conquer that fear, because I saw my name in the annals of history of our own struggles. I knew that it is a significant contribution I've made, but I saw your newspapers, which we consider progressive, I saw them writing my story in terms of what I'd written down, my views about the politics of our country and how I've died in the enemy's lines. So I felt it that I've done something for my country, and these people are killing me because of that belief, because I had the conviction. I had no doubt in my mind, Mkoma Trevor, that I've died for the right thing. I knew it.
So you were envisioning yourself dead. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I knew that somehow, Magaisa was very prominent at the time on Twitter. I knew that Magaisa would write something about how student leaders and young activists contributed to the final coffin in Mugabe's political career, because we were at the pinnacle of pushing Mugabe in 2016. So I considered myself at Whoopi, maybe some of the underrated contributors to the struggle to dislodge more than 3 decades of Mugabe's misrule. So I was in a safe space in my convictions.
You've spoken about the struggle, or rather at your farewell, correct me if I'm wrong here, to the Youth Assembly. You said we've scored victories, losses, and survived challenges together, while remaining focused on the task at hand in transforming the country for change. What, in your view, have been the biggest victories so far that you have scored?
I think that our biggest victory is to allow young people to participate in the politics of our country. When President Tsvangirai passed away, may so rest in power, we were, some of the people were very publicly supporting the emergency of a generation of younger people so that we motivate our colleagues in universities to understand that the fight has to go beyond bones and soup in colleges to the political questions of the day. So I think that our biggest victory was to allow young people to see the need for them to contribute in the politics. Fundamentally, in 2018 and up to 2023, I think young people began to be interested in the politics of our country. The 2023 outcome showed that the coming in of younger people in parliament, in local government, I think to some extent we contributed to that, you know, interest in young people to participate, because most people think that politics is deity, it's for older people. So that intergenerational mix, that how do we harvest from your wisdom and knowledge in the trenches, as Trevor, into the next generation? So instead of being two separate generations, how do we bring intergenerational conversation so that we take from what you have done as a generation and advance it forward and correct what has not been done correctly? So for me, I think that has been the biggest victory in terms of our
country. And the losses?
The losses, I think that our biggest loss is the current status quo. I think I must admit that.
When you are admitting there, I'm going to stop you there, because I think that's we would want to really go there. The current, the loss, as you put it, is the current status quo. You must admit, and I stop you. I want to hear what you're going to admit on the other side. So at home, don't go away. Join us on the other side.
One can't be a hero of two struggles. Those that lifted the Union Jack, Nkoma Trevor, no matter how much they think they're best, they won't be key drivers of this economy's transformation. It doesn't matter how much they try.
Greetings. My name is Trevor Ncube, host of In Conversation with Trevor, Zimbabwe's most engaging conversational show. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. We've brought before your screens change makers from arts, business, and politics, and from the region. Please join our growing community of viewers. Subscribe, like, and share.
Welcome back to our conversation with Gift Ostalos Siziva, activist and human rights defender. I must ask you before I forget, why Ostalos?
I got this name when I was at the university, because of my love for political philosophy, you know, in the Greek, particularly the Greek philosophers. So that's how I got that name, and I've carried it from that day to this day.
So I was saying to you, quoting your own statement, that you've scored victories, losses, and survived challenges together. You focus on the task at hand in transforming the country for change. And I was asking you, what are these losses? And you were saying the losses amount to the current status quo. And you're going to admit something. What are you going to admit?
Thank you very much. I think that the admission for me personally as a generation, I think that we've not done so much to resolve the current status quo. It's a pity, you know, what our people have been subjected to, and the silence in the body politic by our own generation, and we can't sublet our future into the hands of those that fought the liberation struggle, because I think that I'm convinced, Mkoma Trevor, that every generation ought to fight its own struggles, as Fanon would say. And to a greater extent, we haven't fulfilled. We might have realized what our obligation is, that we have to take our struggle to the next level, but we haven't done so for different reasons. Maybe we've not been prepared enough. Maybe we've not, because Lenin says, to the extent that the masses, the ordinary people, are not engaged and informed, the leadership is to be blamed. So we...
That's a powerful statement right there. Because what you are saying, I sense a disjuncture between your powerful philosophical position, the Lenin's view about how the revolution ought to be prosecuted, and the fact that you're not connecting with the people. Young men from Tshabalala, Phelandaba, you know how people are suffering. How is it that you've not been able to get the people along to understand that political education that you're talking about, where I was blaming my father, you are blaming your father.
Yeah.
We ought to be much more mature than that. Yeah. Why that don't happen?
I think the first thing is the legacy of colonialism and the Mugabe era. The fact that regime lived on the basis of fear. For the past 40 years, the regime has managed to make Zimbabweans afraid. So people of my own generation are petrified. Mm. They don't think that the problems is political. So that's why people get inspiration from someone who has stolen from them. They find nothing wrong with that. People don't want to question. One of our leaders, James Chitawa, the former MP of Mavuku, a friend of mine, was abducted in broad daylight in town. And people just, we can't participate. So this need that, and so the first thing is fear. That is the first problem that is in our society. Mm. People are just afraid.
Mm.
The second thing is that our people are looking for a messiah. Che Guevara says, I'm not a liberator. Liberators don't exist. The people liberate themselves. So the lack of urgency on ordinary people, but I'm focused more on younger people, because political urgency is driven by younger people. Where we are to blame is that we've not done sufficient political education and consciousness.
Why?
I think that no one really prepared our generation sufficiently, I would say, for the task at hand. And many people capitulate. You get arrested several times. Mm. There's no building up of the agency from activists to the majority of our people in our own generation. So that makes it difficult, and the personal tour then goes to the personal. So when a few people can identify as activists and leaders, they're isolated. Mm. So the biggest equation we must answer is, how do we move from a cycle where the collective or the leaders are identified outside the people? So we can't remain where we are. We have to go back. Basically, I always write, going back to basics, mm. building from below.
So the going to your point about Zichai Buvara, we're all liberated.
Yes.
The agency sits with each one of us. And what I'm going to posit to you and push back as much as possible is, we're not going to be given marks about our ability to describe
the situation. Yeah.
We're going to be given marks about our ability to empower the citizens, give them agency, excite them out of their fear. Is that not where the opposition has failed? Being able to say, Trevor, yes, you are afraid, but are you aware of the benefits that you might get from liberating yourself from the fear? Why is it that in this crass, crippling poverty, the people are not moved by the opposition? Is the fear that overwhelming, is my theory?
I think that for me, the way I philosophize the Zimbabwean question, the opposition has its role that it has to play. And when some of us are there, try to the best of our ability to play our role in the opposition, the decay in the politics, the assault that Zimbabwe has faced goes beyond political parties. If you look at how civil society has been destroyed through the PVO bill, trinkets and trappings, people being forced, being manipulated, if you look at the how the media in this country has been collapsed, and the entire body politic. So it's a complete overhaul of society. And those that have done so really studied how they want to successfully destroy the fabric of our society. So they knew that everything must collapse. Look at the assault in the constitution itself. That's one. Look at the assault in parliament. How does parliament get reduced to be what it is today? So it was it was not by accident. Forget these people that you see having been counted responsible. Someone orchestrated the assault on the values and the pillars of the very fabric of our constitutional democracy. Let's destroy parliament. Look at what's happening in the cities. Let's destroy these centers of livelihood for ordinary people, for them to access the basic services.
So that they depend on us.
So no one has been spared. If you are in media and you are progressive, you can account to the assault that you have suffered. If you are in political parties, if you are in public space, in the academy,
so again, the same. We are describing the situation. How do we fix this?
I think that the first thing that must happen is that we have to acknowledge that we have a crisis. Political parties like where we belong must acknowledge. The progressive forces in September 99, what convened to give birth to the movement for democratic change was not members of the political party. It was the members of the democratic contingent, which is the progressive forces, students, civic society, the church, workers, and so forth. So the progressive forces in the country must first acknowledge that the present is holding the future in suffocation. And when we acknowledge that, we'll be able to then say, how do we exit from the crisis? The convergence is important. And we've said that in our political organization. Because convergence will allow us to come up with a collective way forward and rescue program of action for Zimbabwe. Because when people continue to operate in their own little silos, they get victimized and these problems continue, the status quo ante will continue. So I think personally as an individual that we're in a point where convergence must be so that we agree. What do journalists say is the problem? What do political activists say is the problem? What does the church, the civil society, women, groups, the vendors, unemployed young people, what do they say is the problem? So that when we agree, we can then agree on how do we exit from where we are. Because the people that have oppressed our country are accountable, you know, and they are not...
5, 10, 11
exactly
people.
The fault.
So what I'm... Correct me if I'm wrong here. What I'm hearing you saying is, let's all admit we failed. Let's all admit and honor to our mistakes. Push back as much as you want. We've made mistakes in the opposition as journalists and so forth. And I'm taken to your point of the old man beating you up, who is saying to you, what are you trying to do? How do you get to that man to say, no, actually what I'm doing is I'm fighting for you. I'm fighting for you in the army to be paid well. I'm fighting for you in the police force to be paid well, so that this convergence for all Zimbabweans, and I'm going to use your term, okay, we're broken.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah.
And I keep on saying, anybody right now who says I'm not broken is terribly broken. All of us right now should own up and say, we're messed up. We are all messed up. Let's own this thing. After owning this thing, let's fix it. Do you want to push back?
I think that I slightly disagree on, on ownership of failure, because I think we must own up that we've been assaulted. We must accept that. We must do, when we're in the CCC, we did an audit of the experience in 2023. And one of the things that came out was that we must acknowledge and accept that we've been assaulted, and identify the person and the people that have assaulted us. Why am I saying so? Because I don't think that the question lies squarely on saying, Trevor, you didn't do well, or Stalos, you didn't do well, because you are the men and women in the arena.
You're right.
These challenges that we faced, very few people will still remain on the arena with the current challenges. By now, if you look at ordinary Zimbabweans, they no longer really expect anything from the government. They now think we can live exclusively outside the state. And that's how broken our country is. So those who have still remained in the arena and said the state must account, I think they're the smallest silent victories that we've remained true to our conviction despite the assault. So for me, the question is first on, we must acknowledge that we've been assaulted, that we've been damaged, that we've been attacked. That's what must happen. But we've remained to the arena, and we must celebrate that. And then once we do that, Koma Trevor, I think it will then allow us to use... So two things are problematic, and I want to go back to the description of the Zimbabwean problem. The first thing I think is the political culture. We must change our political culture as a nation, because the regime invested for years. Mugabe knew that I must divide people. I must put people in their own stratas. Vendors must not understand the teacher's struggles. Teachers must not understand the journalist struggles. Journalists shouldn't understand political activist struggles. So people think it's your struggle.
Yeah.
Fight.
Yeah.
So we need to first shut down these compartments and come together. That's the first thing. And understand the force of unity. That's the first thing, as those who are driving transformation in different sectors. The second thing, I think we need to embrace the force of logic. Our politics is not driven by the force of logic. Our political conversation, and Mugabe invested so much to lead our country into a situation where superior logic does it matter. And that's why Zimbabweans now then start to look for Messiah, and religion has done more damage to the political culture of subcontracting and suppressing the force of logic and its superiority. So I think that's the most important thing. Those two things, the unity of the progressive forces and them understanding that you can't operate in silos. The struggles of teachers should be my struggle, and I must understand it that way. And then I must understand that we must change the nature of political conversation from competition to complementary politics.
Cooperation.
How do we cooperate? How do we complement? Because that will bring the war veterans into the conversation. They'll begin to understand that these young people who are talking about democracy are not Western. These are patriotic Zimbabweans. They have a generational, patriotic, and ideological duty, not to destroy, but to fulfill the unfinished business of the liberation struggle. Because one can't be a hero of two struggles. Those that lifted the Union Jack, Nkoma Trevor, no matter how much they think they are best, they won't be key drivers of this economy's transformation. It doesn't matter how much they try. Their generation is not going to transform the economy. The people who are going to transform this economy are the post-independence generation. They must acknowledge it. Those who are coming in, the post-independent generation, must acknowledge that their struggle is not disconnected to the ideas of the liberation project. They are there to fulfill it,
but
not
they
to
will
punish.
Not yield willingly. That's the thing.
Of course, that is a question that the collective ought to answer now, to say, look, these people, for different reasons, some of them is obviously power, primitively accumulated wealth, and crimes that they committed. So that's why the conversation now, when we are going to go into the next political conversation for us in political parties, I think that my major contribution is going to be about dealing with the question of transition, having skilled people to deal with power transfer in this country. ZANU-PF has never had a power transition mechanism since the liberation struggle. So the conversation must be there. How do we translate the collective will of the people into a democratic breakthrough? The question is not on voting. The question is not on the economy. The question is on transition. Skilled people, technical people, with an understanding what it will take to have Zimbabwe. Look at how they resolve their own internal contradictions in 2017. Internal transition in the ruling party. Look at how they intend to resolve the current transitional problem now. All efforts are seemingly failing, and look at what the conversation is leading to. And some of us are very cautious about that path because...
Is it not, I'm going to hold you there, is that not also the same ailment within the opposition? The transitions have been broken briefly. What you're outlining as far as ANPEF is concerned is 100% correct. They've never had a transition. But has there been transition mechanism within the opposition?
I think there were. I think I would successfully argue as a political scientist that there have been transition, successful transition in the democratic movement. Particularly the major transfer was from President Tsvangirai to President Chamisa. Though obviously there were lessons to learn from the process, right? Outside the will of the people, procedures and so forth. How do you ensure that you are within the confines of the spirit and letter of your own?
But that's a small...
But I think that when you look at the democratic movement, so I think that fundamentally to a greater extent there has been. The biggest thing I think is for the democratic forces in this country is how do we manage contradictions.
I want to take you to that point because you've said a number of things which I think are fundamentally important. The transition process, getting people that understand this, transfer of power. You're talking about convergence. You're talking about the progressive democratic forces coming together. What does that look like to you? Some of us are pushing for the NTA, which is a very ambitious project, National Transitional Authority. Because also, again, to a point that you've mentioned, I believe, and push back as much as you may, I don't believe that right now we do have a single political party or a single political player that can get us out of this. I want to go to your point about let's restore the agency to each one of us, each one of our organizations, and say we all need to come together to have a conversation about how broken we are and how we move ourselves from this. And some of us are positive that perhaps the best idea is an NTA. It might work. Maybe some people have bright ideas out there. What do you say to that? What's your pushback on that?
I think that the idea of an NTA, we once, when we were in the CCC after the election, we proposed that there is a problem with the election. The election has been manipulated. And we knew that the lack of legitimacy to those that are forcefully taking power, President Chamisa had won the election, but the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, against every credible observer mission in the country, decided to announce the winner. We argued that this gives birth to the genesis of another vicious crisis in our country. But there's no political legitimacy. The people that have been voted for are not there. And then that crisis translates into performance legitimacy, the economy, social service, and the challenges we face today. And so we propose that there must be a transitional mechanism to take us back into a credible election. And we proposed it and we put it out there because we felt that Zimbabwe has to be rescued back into a process that will give those who govern a mandate. So there are fault lines, with great respect to the proposition about the NTA, in my own, and these are my personal view as a student. I think that the first fault line is that I think we should not put the cart before the horse. Even if we know that this is destination, process legitimacy is important. How do we get to that defined legitimacy? Because the intentions are the same. The intention is to rescue our country. So how do we bring, like I've identified, the progressive forces, the collective of our country into the table?
I want to press you there. Answer that question. How do we do it?
I think...
You're 100% right. Process is important. But how do we do it?
I think let's take lesson from the National People's Convention of 99. I think people ought to look at what defines the social forces now? Who are these people? Where are the vendors?
I'm going to stop you again. Very important question. The process. Let's not forget it. What's the process of getting us to a place that gives legitimacy, that allows a democratic process to take effect? The NTA might not be the destination, but what's the process of getting us to the promised land, perhaps? At home, don't go away. Join us on the other side as a gift response to those issues. So see you on the other side.
I think that Geza is, my personal view is that he is an expression of the crisis of the performance legitimacy facing the country. He is now expressing what all of us has been saying.
Welcome back to our conversation with Gift Ostalos Seziva. Before we go to the huge and perhaps one of the most important points of this conversation, which is your idea of what the transition process ought to be, I want people to understand who you are. So where were you born?
So I was born in Chabalala, in Bulawayo. I went to school there in Mahlabezulu Primary School, and then went to Glock High School in the farm school. And then, of course, came to Arrel for the first time when I was admitted at the University of Zimbabwe.
How old were you when you first came to Arrel?
I first came to Arrel when I was 19 years. Mm. That is in 2012. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you said, what did you read at UZ?
My first degree was in political science. And then I did a master's in international relations.
At the University?
At the University of Zimbabwe, yes.
Who were your political science lecturers? Simple as Tole?
And unfortunately, Makumbe.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, Makumbe was one of our major mentors academically. It was a pleasure, of course, to be at the university during his time. Mm. And of course, Masunungure, very critical lecturer who guide us in our political philosophy, you know, understanding as intellectuals. So, yeah.
Were you involved in student politics?
Precisely, I led the students' union.
You did?
In 2014.
You were the president?
Yes, and in up to 2015, mm-hmm. I was in the helm of the union. And, of course, we practiced a lot, you know, of political activism.
I was vice president of the student union.
Oh,
so,
that's
we share.
Well, a little something. That's good. Yeah. So the union shaped our understanding of the politics at the university, and of course left to go to the party. I served in the national executive, and then elected of the MTC,
okay.
And then elected the general secretary of the youth, and then a career role which was cut short when I was transitioned into joining the elite organ of the organization, which happened so early. I think it limited some of my youth exuberance, joining the standing committee as the deputy to Fadzai, a fantastic boss I had, but obviously meant more responsibility and leaving most of the activism we were doing in this. So we're forced to basically transition and mature faster.
Very quick.
Because of those redeployment by the party.
You did a postgraduate certificate, isn't it, in leading nonviolent movements. And you also did something with the John F. Kennedy School.
Yeah.
So you've continued to do some schooling. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I think it has been important because I came from the radical left as a Marxist. And one of our beliefs was that...
The radical left. Because they say if you're a radical left after 40, there's something wrong with you. Are you still a radical left?
I'm on the center of the left now because of the movement's ideological
position. So you've also been...
I've moved to the center. I'm convinced that we have to remain at the center. Obviously, I wouldn't go to the right. I don't think there are solutions for the oppressed on the right. I think that the left and the center have to continue their struggles. Mm. So because I was grounded by radical left politics in the International Socialist Organization.
I'll stop you there. Is there no place for pragmatism in politics? Is there no place for shelling off the right and the left and being in a space that says, I'm here to do good by the people and what works for the people and is ethical and principled, that's what I'm going to do?
I think social democratic values are precisely a negotiation of the understanding that being in the extreme left might not be sustainable to transform the material realities of our people in the now. And then the understanding that there are some good elements from the right, particularly around how do we build strong institutions, how do we maintain some of the rights, for example, to private property, as it were. So it's a negotiation where we are. The democratic developmental state, that idea that we believe in, that the future of this country can only be because private capital is very good in making profit, but it's not good in redistributing it. So the state must continue playing a regulatory role. So some of us are convinced that the future of the African continent and Zimbabwe in particular is going to be on the center-left, social democratic, a developmental state, because industrialization is going to be our driving force into the future as we get to govern this country. So to industrialize, state will play a very critical role. But now, we must build the capacity of the state. We must not leave the state in its Marxist form. We must build the capacity of the state to have strong institutions, for example, the fight against leakages, corruption, and so forth. So I think that the center-left, a developmental state, is a practical way because it negotiates both the interests of the right and the left.
Yeah, the I like the negotiating thing because I think actually my experience is as I have grown up, I have negotiated with myself, realizing what works and what doesn't.
Precisely.
I used to teach history of economic thought, socialist economic thought at the University of Zimbabwe. I used to be a leftist.
Yeah.
I have moved from being a leftist to more, you know, center left. Because I see that there's certain things that are not workable as a radical and certain things that are not workable as a right-wing capitalist, as it were. So you come in the middle. So talk to me about how you have grown from being a student activist, politician, to somebody now in you've been promoted to the organs of a key opposition political party. How have you grown as an individual and a politician?
I think that the first and most important thing is ideological grounding. Because the major problem, as we philosophize it, of Zimbabwe right now, is that we have a ruling class without ruling ideas. So for me, the process of ideation is important. To continue investing on thought leadership and ideological analytical lenses to society's problems. So that's the first and most important thing. I'm doing my PhD now, and I'm trying to interrogate some of these contradictions in the emergence of younger people with the University of Free State.
Okay.
So I think that the continuous search of knowledge and ideas is very, very important because our country right now is led by people that are ideologically vacuous and that have no idea of where we are going, but more importantly about where we are coming from. It's a very indictment on the liberation project, but that's the reality. Those that are dominating the state now, there's no governing philosophy. There's no idea. What is it that informs Mthuli's policies? That's why he goes to the right, Mutsonga goes to the left. So these contradictions and confusion is the reason why the growth for us and for me in particular is ideation. Not to abandon the continuous search of knowledge and ideas. Secondly, I think that two things are fundamentally important. Character and integrity. This it lacks in our body politic. And I strive to the best of my abilities because President Chamisa once said to me, I don't expect you to be a saint because you're not Saint Ostalos. But do things that at least are within, you know, the moral fabric of our society. When people hated this, they must not be shocked. So I think that the moral fiber of those who decide to occupy public office is important. Integrity, character, humility, I think is important. So as you grow and transition, when we were youth, for example, I would pick up fights, direct political fight with those in the leadership of the movement for different issues, because you can easily be lobbied, hired to, you know, to attack this one and this one because of some of the conversations in politics. So when you transition from that, I think you need to invest to understand that we need to have conversations. We need to use the force of logic. We should not criminalize people holding different views. Mm. So it goes back to these precious values that anyone needs when you're going into public office or you're doing anything to do with the public, to be humble, to have integrity, and to have character, and most importantly, honest.
Very important. But I want to pause it and push back as much as possible. That the issue of the absence of character and integrity affects the entire political ecosystem in Zimbabwe. That the questions of lack of integrity and character applies to the ruling party. I mean, ZANU-PF is rotten, it's corrupt and everything else.
Yeah.
But the opposition has not emerged as leaders when it comes to integrity and character. Is that a fair assessment?
Our argument and proposition, Koma Trevor, having been in the trenches for the Democratic Alternative for 2 decades, we have said going forward, we need to build a credible alternative. Building a credible alternative means it's an acknowledgement that so while these were assaulted, the party criminally taken over, our offices criminally and violently taken over by men and women military fatigue, it presents us with an opportunity to reset and to restart. We take what has worked from the past. What are the good things? Our relations with the people, our ability to connect with the people and the good things. But we also correct what has not worked. Right. Whether we acknowledge it publicly or not, internally in our own organization, as we plan going into the future, we start from position of acknowledgement to say, we have agreed as a leadership collective that what we have to build going into the future is a credible alternative. It means that we will not need to convince you as a voter, particularly the middle class. Our vision and mission for some of us is that when we launch a political alternative going into the future, you don't need to be convinced by seeing us there. On your own, you must see that, no, these issues that we raise, there's so many because we don't have time to go one-on-one on them. Even if we have not written public that we hate you, we have the list of all these things that Zimbabweans. I think that first and foremost, I think people are saying, don't cut corners. Let's have principled leaders. Zimbabweans have echoed that. Grassroots people are saying, let people go through, you know, process for them to, for example, when we debate the deployment policy in parliament and in local authorities, I think people are fed up of these experiences of going into an election and then problems and stuff like that.
Internally.
Mm. I think that our people are convinced that we must ensure that there is proper and due process that produces people that are credible
internally
to represent the organization. We are not proud of the mess that we see in the cities as an example. So questions of quality and substance come into play. Because if we deploy you into local government, you go there and support privatization of water. It's an indictment on us and our deployment policy. So that's one lesson that we've carried and understood. Because
second one.
The second one, I think that is obviously about how do we deal with internal contradictions, mm-hmm. or ability to manage contradictions in the organization going into the future.
Very important.
Yeah. I can't remember some of it, but I think that there is an alphabet of these things. And our raw data brought it to us as a leadership to say, going into the future, we have learned our lesson.
But should you, I love that. But should you know, and I like the fact that you want to get to a point where people like me, if as people like myself, look at you and say, okay, maybe they're changed. Is the starting point a transparent, candid admission? We made a mistake. We are sorry. We are part of causing this thing. Because the assault happened.
But the opposition participated in the assault by not behaving like an opposition. Okay? So I'm saying, should we not have you guys say, we are sorry we messed up? Because you can't come to me and say we've had you without apologizing to say, we ignored what you were saying at some point. We are sorry. We've heard you. We've listened to you. These are the 14 things that you brought to us. So that I can see that bar. Because for me, leadership that apologizes is leadership that ends my trust. But the leadership that pretends they are perfect, they don't make mistakes, I worry about. What's your push?
I think that we have publicly acknowledged and took responsibility for the things that we might count to have been our own inadequacies. So I think that those who look into us, we've looked ourselves in the mirror as the democratic opposition. And at times people, because of different orientations and belief and mistrust that happened over the years, people tend to selectively listen to the extent that maybe people will miss the antidotes of our acknowledgement.
I will push back and say, you are trying to sell something to me. You can't blame me for not buying what you're selling.
Of course, okay? Of course.
So you've got to keep on coming back to me and say, Trevor, we think you selectively heard this. We're going to keep on repeating it until you get it. Don't you think that's what...
Of course. I mean, it's a lesson for us because we intend to win the hearts and minds, not of the people that have been supporting us, of the people that have fundamentally differed with us. That's our objective. That's why we're talking about building a credible alternative. And it can't be credible until and unless those that hold different opinions with us might continue holding them, but acknowledge of the huge potential that the democratic alternative holds in its ability to bring a democratic breakthrough. So definitely, I mean, there will be investment in that kind of conversation and the intention to use the force of logic and its superiority for people to understand where we're coming from and where we intend to go. Because at the end of the day, this struggle we are prosecuting is not about ourselves. It's about the men and women who have put trust into our responsibility to transform their lives.
Absolutely. You have admired your loyalty to Nelson Chamisa. Talk to me about what it is about his leadership that makes you so loyal to him.
Thank you very much. I think that the first thing is that President Chamisa is one person who has offered himself to mentor the next generation of leaders in our country. When he became the president of the party, the first thing he did was to open a platform, which is a bit private, for party activists, but then continue to engage other young people. Number two, his ability to be able to connect with people regardless of their race, their tribe, their ethnicity. Our politics had previously been poisoned. I come from Matabele land, and anyone would have expected that President Chamisa would not say we cannot mentor young people based on the fact that we have differences in ethnicity. But his ability to open his mind to younger people, regardless of where they are coming from, without shared historical experiences, and say, I offer myself to train you so that you young boys and young girls can become better leaders for the country. That's one. And number two, I think that politics requires a certain ability to commit to the struggle. Our politics has a lot of challenges. Those who have been in politics will tell you, have the smallest experience in the struggle. But these few years have learned the toughness of the politics. But to remain true to the cause, just to remain there, that to remain on the arena. And most importantly, I think that President Chamisa's ability and work ethic. We went with President Chamisa and we got tired in some of the rallies. We're doing 3 rallies a day and we asked ourselves, how does this man survive? His ability to, we have to push, we have to work. These people, our future depends on this. So for me, it's the work ethic, it's the commitment, it's the love to not limit oneself just to themselves, but to others. How do we make others become part and parcel, particularly for us who were younger, who came into the struggle? We're not there in 99. We identify with it, but we're not physically there. And we felt that we might be left out on the basis that we have no ownership of the big genesis of the democratic movement. So to be allowed, to be mentored, to be corrected, to be trained, because we needed a leader also had patience with us.
Yeah.
We're not perfect. So that art of perfecting the next generation. And lastly, I think the ability to understand that you can't be a steward if you're not prepared to be a disciple. So discipleship has been taught to, for us to understand that. You have to know that stewards don't start as stewards. They start as disciples. Mm. They ought to be trained.
Have you ever disagreed with him on anything?
Several times.
And how do you handle those?
I think that that's one untold experience about President Chamisa. He allows people to hold different opinions, particularly internal. When I went to the standing committee, I almost bawled out because I was not used to this couch of debate where Gladys is standing up. They say, no, this, and then Huchi, the late Honorable MP, holds another different opinion and stuff like that. I thought that everyone, because I believed in democratic centralism. So I felt that if the president says this week, or I was in the youth assembly, then I now go to this platform. They're debating. Someone is saying this, someone is saying that.
There was debate
and people holding different opinions. At one point in the youth assembly, we had a meeting with the president as the youth. Someone challenged the president in our presence. You know, I was shocked and I was like, this guy. But the president said, no, allow him. What is your point? So, and then I've differed with him on many occasions internally on the program
and
of action.
Survived.
And I've survived. And I've not seen me being punished for holding that different view. Mm. Because his argument has always been that, look, we must sit in the table, disagree, fight. But when we go out there, we agree. So that's why you see me 99% of my time, I agree. When we went to the by-election, for example, the party resolved that we must go back to the by-election as CCC. We said, look, but we can't go back as CCC because this party has been taken over by the regime. We should go in as independent. But the decision of the party, after a long debate, maintained that we go with CCC. I went publicly and say, I'll go back to parliament, race to the by-election as CCC. But I knew my fate. And I accepted it. And I said, you have sacrificed us, but you are also testing to what extent can you abide by the internal resolution of the organization.
Tell me, do you think you rather own up to one big miscalculation as a politician that you've had? When you look back, what's been your biggest mistake, biggest miscalculation that you regret?
I think that my biggest regret in politics is to some extent, abandon the role of comradely love in pursuit of, individual control. My greatest lesson in the party were not when I was deputy to FADSA. I think things were flawed. It was designed. I had no problems until this very day when I was put there. But in the youth, you know, I think that that's where I learned my lesson the most. And I learned that we shouldn't individualize our struggle. Most of the time out there, political contradictions that are personal. You know, you didn't say this to me, you questioned this in front of people. And
comradely love, you say.
Comradely love, I think it's the...
Please unpack that for me. I mean, that's huge.
I think comradely love is the ability to feel for your comrade. That I am because we are. It takes us back to Ubuntu. That is, comrade, at all material times, I must understand that whatever contradictions and problem we must have, you are a comrade. We are brought together. You come from Roman Catholic, SDA, AFM. What brings us together are not those religious differences. It is the common destiny for Zimbabwe. Mm. So how do we able to tolerate each other's weaknesses for the benefit of ordinary people who have put trust on us as a leadership? So for me, comrade love will limit some of our individual excesses as we prosecute our struggle.
Interesting. Let's go back to the big question, the transition, the process. How do you see, because for me, I must put my cards on the table here and say repeat what I've said, which is, I do not see an election under the current circumstances resolving this. There are entrenched interests that would not allow a free and fair election. Let's not fool ourselves. And the rules have been rigged already. Point number one. Point number two, the opposition is in a mess. ZANU-PF is corrupt. It's rotten. We are broken. You've said that, and I've said that. We are broken as a society. How do we fix this collective brokenness? The people in the ruling party who want this thing to continue are people that are eating right now, who are getting the contracts, who are close to the president and his family and everything else. There's opposition within the ZANU-PF to ZANU-PF.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you and I must be interested in how do we, for your children, do you have children now?
No, no.
Okay. For your children and my grandchildren, what country are they going to inherit? And I believe if you love this country, that's what we ought to be invested in. How do you solve that issue?
I think, like, it's
focusing on the process.
I think that the first thing, let's take lesson from the 1990s yes. convention, because it was the process that matters for me as I read it. So I think that the first thing is to identify the social forces in the country. Where are the people? Are they in the informal sector? Are they in the profession? Are they in universities? Are they in embassies? Are they in the civic society? Where are the people? That is the question.
Sure.
Let's locate where the citizens are. Once we locate where the citizens are, we then begin a process of convergence, which is what we propose when we're in the Democratic Alternative, that we must then foster a process of convergence of these key social and political forces so that one...
So how does this convergence look like?
So in black and white...
Describe it. What does it look like?
In black and white, I think that...
a conference?
It can be a setup like a conference, yeah. Probably convened, for example, maybe by the church or convened by the progressive, labor movements.
Mm-hmm.
It has been fractured now, but, you know, there must be those who convene the conversation for Zimbabwe. So, because we don't have to start on the end result. Let's start on the conversation so that you define the problem. We define the problem. Mm. They define the problem. Then we see that, okay, these are points of convergence. Mm. When we locate that, that is what we call the national question.
Mm.
We'll get to agree on the national question. When we agree, we'll then agree on the program of action
mm-hmm.
that will lead us. We agree that, and we propose the Democratic Opposition that, look, we have to take our country back to legitimacy. That is into a free and fair election. But like you say, under the circumstances, it is difficult and utterly impossible. So to do that, we then propose that the mechanism that must be there is a mechanism that will allow Zimbabweans to talk, Zimbabweans to look back,
yeah.
and Zimbabwe to look into the future.
Mm.
Once we look into the future, we're able to say, this is the common destiny. That becomes the vision for Zimbabwe. Right now, we don't know where we are going. A few would know where we are coming from, but majority have no idea.
How long do you see this process happening? Because the we are in 2025. Constitutionally, there should be an election in 2028. Do you see this process happening before then? If that doesn't happen, you and I know that those that want to grab and run with this thing in 2028 or 2030 will do that. And then we're waiting for another. So how long do you see this process take?
I personally don't think it must be pivoted in the electoral cycle for obvious reasons. I also believe that it must be centered on what the genesis of the problem. In our movement, we philosophize the problem as the problem of the unresolved question of 2023. That's where we start. But others have to bring where they start in terms of the genesis of the problem. In that way, we'll be able to, I wouldn't know, for example, the hypothetical time frames, but I know that once we find ourselves in that platform in space, some of us will be happy because it doesn't matter how long it is going to take.
Yeah.
Nelson Mandela stayed in prison for 21 years.
Mm.
So I don't think that it will matter when we'll get there, but it will give some of us comfort that we have we are now in the genesis of resolving the political question. Because right now, Mkoma Trevor, our country faces a crisis of uncertainty. And as a political scientist, I can tell you that once there is uncertainty, you face an imminent danger. That's where military interventions come in and unsustainable
processes. Well, that's where the desperation, you know. And this is going to be the last question. There's so much I want to talk about. You and I could talk on forever. The Geza conundrum that we face, you know, we have this man called Blessed Geza that nobody's heard about, that suddenly excites the nation, and there's a shutdown that's forever. You have a man called Chavango that nobody's heard about. I will sit in your chair and comes and grabs this thing, and some people, could these things be avoidable? Are we that desperate?
I think that Geza is, my personal view is that he is an expression of the crisis of the performance legitimacy facing the country. He's now expressing what all of us have been saying, that there are problems that are political in the country. Mm. And he now then represents another section that had been silent on this challenge. When I did a press conference just after the eve of the election, in fact, post the election, I did a press conference and we argued that if we don't resolve this issue, we are going to start seeing it. And we're calling for those who didn't want to participate in the conference that you're going to start seeing this. And Geza is now expressing it in terms of how soldiers are experiencing the crisis, the security sector,
the war veterans,
members of ZANU-PF. So these have been the silent people when we're defining the crisis. So he's an expression of the song that some of us have been singing about the crisis in the country and the need for leadership. We have a slight difference on what should happen, right? But we have an agreement around the definition of the crisis.
So the last question there before we go to books, by the way. Gee, we've been going on for a long time. Could the Chavango thing have been avoided?
It
as brief as possible.
But I think it could be avoided.
It
could have been avoided. I wouldn't know how, because I was the man in the arena, and I can tell you that we knew when it came in that it is a continuation of our fight with the regime. So we never saw him as anything significant in the bigger fight, but we knew that he's being used because they've done that before. So history is our teacher on the Chabangu case, that they'd done that to the MDC alliance and they were doing it. And our crime was that we'd refused to go into the TEPU without conditions to join Pollard. That was the fun. So our crime was, one, not to go into Pollard, and secondly, a refusal to go into Parliament on the first day.
Wow, I would have loved us to go deeper into that. So I'm going to turn to books, if you don't mind.
Of course.
My first recommendation is, there's a capitalist in me. Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. It's a beautiful book of how one of the world's richest men created his world. Beautiful book that I recommend. I'm all for these days for AI. This is a great book. I've recommended it before. Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. Great book. Again, this is a time for people like you in the opposition to understand what AI is, to form their policies about AI. We should have a minister of AI right now. I think somebody clearly understand what AI is. Politicians and business
leaders.
The other book, again, I've recommended this book before, but because I see the importance of technology central to where this nation is going, is a book called Life After Google, The Fall of Big Data and the Rise of the Blockchain Economy. What books are you going to recommend? Three books at least? I know you have a pile, but I just want three.
Okay. Thanks. I think.
And why are you recommending them?
I think Towards a Democratic Developmental State is important for Zimbabwean readers, because
by
by Dr. Kanyenze.
Okay.
I think Kanyenze, the work by Kanyenze, Debros and others, beginning with Beyond the Enclave up to towards democratic development of state, I think it's very important in where we are, because we want to see how do we rescue Zimbabwe beyond the current mess. I think secondly, obviously, for people like you in business, I think you must look at the future of capitalism, mm-hmm. Because you get to understand why Paul Collier.
Oh, yes, yes. I've got it in my head.
Yes, it's important because it unpacks the contradiction that capitalism face in the present moment and why some of us remain in the center left. So I think that because we're looking at the role of human beings in the institutions.
Like the way he tells personal stories that relate to healthcare, pensions and so forth, and using illustrating how capitalism is broken. It's a great book.
And then I think lastly, I think people must go back to what should be done by Lenin. I was rereading the book when I had a conversation with the students, and he raised very important thing about the role of the intelligentsia in a revolution. He talks about the vanguard, and his argument is that why is that the intelligentsia must play a central role. So I think those of us who are very active in politics must go back to those basics and begin to understand, because he raises questions around the role of the intelligentsia, but also gives certain guidelines on how they should prosecute this struggle, because history repeats itself. So we are back and we must be able to get instructions from history.
So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
What a pleasure. You know, the young people like you, an asset to the country, your courage. I sense a clarity in thinking, and that's what this nation requires, in opposition, in the ruling party, in business. People who are grounded in values and principles, and not in things, in faiths that come and go. Your courage of standing up and speaking out for the things that you believe in. And I look forward to you and everybody else getting involved in that transition and the convergence that you're talking about. So well done for all that you've done, and looking forward to what Zimbabwe, with your leadership, because some of us are old, with your leadership can do. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Shepa.
You remain seated then. Allow me to address myself to our viewers who are all over the world. We love the love that we're getting from the diaspora. The diaspora now accounts for over 57% to 60% of our viewership. The biggest market being the UK, Australia, South Africa is pretty huge. Thank you so much for your support. Remember, we are a weekly show. We're out every Monday, 7 a.m. on YouTube. We're big on other platforms. So scroll down to see where else you can view us. We've created a whole website where all our content sit, apart from YouTube. You can listen as you wash your cars, as you do your gardens, as you work in the house. We love your comments. Keep them coming. Until next time, cheers to you all.